Hello, and welcome to episode 36 of this podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is Perry Middlemas, and I'm here with the ever studious David Grigg.
Ever studious. You come up with some very interesting descriptions of me, Perry. But, yeah, I suppose that's true. I am a little bit studious, yes.
But, how are you, David?
Oh, you know, all right. I'm coping with things. The weather's improving a bit, warming up a bit, which is nice. And we may eventually be allowed to go out and visit other people, but it might still a way away, isn't it?
Another couple of weeks, I think. So I think the worst thing about the pandemic is that it's becoming tedious.
Yes.
And I'm finding our conversations about it to be just as tedious just going over and over. So I reckon we should just slide straight into what we were going to be talking about, David, rather than just sort of crying on each other's shoulders about how hard done by we are.
Indeed, you're right.
So this week we decided to go back to book reading, which is always a good thing to do. And you and I, David, had been discussing this and realised that we were reading some books which sort of had a similar sort of idea to them. And that is that they were books that had been marketed as being literary novels, but utilised some genre topics. Now, we were referring to these as genre adjacent, but that's probably not the right term.
No.
You've come up with something that's, or found something that's
Bruce Sterling, who wrote a lot of cyberpunk novels, came up some years ago with the term slipstream. I'm not quite sure why that word is applicable, but the concept of slipstream is also this idea of novels which move between, not quite move between genres, but use science fiction or fantasy themes in them, but are not sort of marketed in that sort of way. And that seems to be what that means. But it's a very vague term, but we sort of know what we mean, which is books which are not, certainly not mainstream science fiction, mainstream fantasy, but have elements of those in other kinds of work.
Some recent examples of that, David, were things like P.D. James's book, Children of Men. She had been well known for writing her crime novels, but Children of Men is a really quite excellent novel set in the future. Great film made of it as well, and that was one that utilised strong science fiction themes, but wasn't marketed as such. And then you've got the two books by Kazuo Ishiguro, Nobel Laureate, Never Let Me Go and The Buried Giant, one being about clones and one being about fantasy topics. He got into a lot of trouble with the second of these, The Buried Giant, when he basically appeared to slag off the whole of the fantasy genre. And he was taken to task by no less a person than Ursula K. Le Guin over this. And I think he backed off in a really big hurry, which was probably a very good idea, given that fantasy is probably the oldest genre of literature going back past the Bible way.
It's the origin of all narrative, isn't it, really? I mean,
absolutely.
The myths and legends of gods and monsters, yeah.
Gods and monsters and demons and humans and absolutely all of that. And then, of course, we've also had Ian McEwan, who's got into a bit of trouble recently over the last couple of years with his books, with his novel Machines Like Me, which was about either robots or androids, and he refused to have anything to do with the term science fiction because he said it had something to do with galaxy-busting anti-gravity boots going at 10 million light years an hour or something. So he basically slagged it off completely. And it just goes to show that a lot of it's marketing. Really what it comes down to, I think, with a lot of this is that it all depends on what the publishers are going to put on the front of the book. Back at a time that you and I would have known about fairly well, Harlan Ellison and Kurt Vonnegut both denounced themselves being labelled as science fiction writers. And I actually don't have a problem with that whatsoever. It's up to the writer as to whether they consider themselves to be writing in whatever genre they feel like. If they don't feel as though they're writing in the genre, I also doesn't bother me in the slightest.
No.
What I'm attempting to do, or what I hope that we're attempting to do here today, is to identify some of those novels that are sort of next door to the genre, so genre adjacent, that might be of interest to readers of science fiction, but which might well have passed them by because they didn't even know they existed. There's a lot of these books that come out. And if you think back on it, things like 1984, Animal Farm, Brave New World, all of those things would have been written, or Clockwork Orange, all of those things would have been written purely and simply as literary novels, but at some stage or other got picked up by the science fiction community and bored into the whole of the genre because of the way they handled their topics and what they used and their themes. And it's purely a matter of sort of saying to people, to readers of science fiction, don't just look at the little rocket on the spine in the library or the dragon. They're the ones they put in our library to identify whether they're fantasy or science fiction. Don't just look at those, but have a look at the blurbs on the book to be able to work out what it is that the author is doing, what sort of memes and themes they're using, and whether they are going to be of interest. And hopefully the books we talk about today are going to be of interest to normal genre readers.
Sure. Well, when you first put forward the idea of this as a topic, I was thinking back on my recent reading over the last, 10, 15 years, I suppose, and I could identify heaps of books which I felt fit into this sort of area, because it is, to me, it's the kind of writing I like. I'm not very much, as you know, on the galaxy-busting, gravity-boots sort of science fiction much myself, although occasionally I like it, things like The Expanse. But I do like stuff which is kind of in this edge sort of area, so it was pretty easy for me to pick out of my relatively recent reading a number of books which I thought were appropriate.
If you think back, David, to the time of the early 1960s, which is sort of that era where we're talking in the Hugo time machine at the moment over various episodes. If you cast yourself back to that particular time and then look forward to the year 2020, we're living in a science fictional world.
Yes.
There's a whole lot of things that are in this particular world at the moment, leaving aside the whole of the pandemic, yeah, but all the rest of the technology and where humanity is going is a science fictional world. Now, some people might say it's a shocking dystopia that we're basically living through at the moment, which you could well argue, but it is a science fictional world from that point of view. From our point of view at the moment in 2020, it isn't, but you can see how it could be seen as such. And there's a lot of novels that are being written set in and of this time, which only have a slight little tweak to them, which make them into, sort of a genre adjacent. And those are some of the ones we're going to talk about today.
Mm. All right.
So the first one I wanted to talk about was, interestingly enough, all three of my books today are written by Australian authors.
Oh, good.
Which is good. The first one is a debut novel called A Superior Spectre. I hold it up to the camera so our listener cannot see it. by a woman by the name of Angela Mayer, written in 2018, published by Ventura Press, somewhere in Australia. Angela Mayer has been in and around the literary field for quite some years. She was a lit blogger back in the 2000s. She then became a book reviewer, bookseller, and now she's actually a publisher and now also a published author. And this is her debut novel, marketed as a literary novel, but it crosses over into both the historical and science fictional genres. It's set slightly in the future, in the year 2024, where our protagonist, Jeff, I don't think we ever learn his surname, but it doesn't really matter, is an Australian man dying of a unnamed illness. You can possibly guess what it might be, but let's not bother about that. He's living in a world where everybody's chipped, and so they can keep track of you in terms of where you are, but also in terms of what your health rating is like. And in this version of Australia, the Australian government doesn't want anybody to go without healthcare. It's a little bit of a change in terms of where things are going mostly, I think. Mm-hmm. And anyway, so he decides that he's had enough of his life, doesn't want to live anymore, and has to try and find a place where he can die in peace. So he decides to go back to Scotland and can't get in there for whatever reason. I'm not sure if that's terribly clear, but he can get into England. So he gets into England and then gets across the border into Scotland because he wants to find somewhere where he can go and he can just die in peace. Now, he realises that he's going to need a bit of help. So he actually picks up what is referred to in the book as an and serve, A-N-D-S-E-R-V, so android servant, so sort of like a robot that is a humanised sort of robot which can basically help him with his feeding, cleaning, getting around and all that sort of stuff. But he also picks up some new technology, which is basically in the form of a chemical tab or of some sort, which he's able to take. And it's a new technology and allows him to be able to transfer his mind into somebody in the past. And as it happens, what he ends up doing is he ends up landing in the mind of a young woman called Leonora, who lives in Scotland in the 1860s. Now, Leonora is living a hand-to-mouth existence with her father on a farm. Mother died when Leonora was very young. Father meets another woman, decides that he's going to marry her. Probably best if the daughter goes and moves out and actually tries to find a husband because Leonora is coming up to about 18 or so. So the father thinks that she's about time for her to leave. So he sends her off to live with her aunt in Edinburgh. Now, Jeff has been told right at the very beginning when he gets these tabs that he should really only do this three times. Not told why, but warned that he should only do this three times. Jeff just totally disregards this and just keeps going back into Leonora's mind. He will spend an hour in his mind in his time, but it's basically a day in her time. It's just the timelines slip. The further back you go, you can spend an hour of your time, but it would be a month of theirs. Anyway, so he starts getting to know what she is and he starts vicariously living her life, figuring out that all of her emotions, her thoughts, her sexuality, all of this stuff starts impinging on him. And his thoughts start dripping into hers. And she starts seeing visions of things, basically visions of Melbourne. In fact, it's listed as Melbourne, because this is where Jeff has come from originally. So she's seeing images of this modern city by the bay and thinks they're hallucinations. She thinks she's starting to go mad. She can't understand what is going on, and she actually tells somebody and ends up in an asylum. By this stage, Jeff is sort of gradually deteriorating, and he's trying to stay longer and longer with Leonora as his final grab of life, if you like. So he knows what he's doing, but he disregards the fact that he's actually impacting this young woman back in the 1860s. It's the story of how he deteriorates and she deteriorates at the same time, but the two personalities slowly come together and slowly start to merge. Now, the book is told from the first person point of view of each of the two main characters. When I've read some of these in the past and they don't put any indication at the top of the sections where a new point of view starts, sometimes it's difficult to work out who the actual person is. Mm-hmm. Because some of these sections, you'll have two or three in a row of one particular character and then one of the other one and then go back to alternating. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you can't really go in terms of, oh, it's this person's turn or it's that person's turn. But Mayer's got a good enough technique to be able to, within the first one or two sentences, give you enough of a pointer so that you know immediately who this person is until you get near the end of the book. And then for a couple of them, you think, hang on, she's messed this up. She hasn't done this right. And then you realise, no, hang on, she's done this perfectly because she's got to the point where the two personalities have got so close together that an outside observer like myself can't actually pick the difference between the two. She's handled that really, really well. And I think that that shows a real got lot of really, really good technique in this particular book. And it really comes across as really, really quite excellent. But there's a couple of other things that I wanted to bring up. At one point at one point she talks about the images that this particular person is Leonora is seeing, and she talks about this image of this sort of bard, she calls him, who's got this bright red hair and looks tall and thin and very pale faced, and she can't work out if he's this person's a male or a female. And I thought, that sounds like David Bowie. So I went and checked up on Angela Mayer, as you do, stalking on the internet.
Sure,
and
sure.
She is a David Bowie fan. Yeah. So that one snuck through. But the other one I really thought was excellent was one where Jeff is thinking about the film Midnight Cowboy, John Voight and Dustin Hoffman, yep, as you recall. And then three or four pages later, Leonora is sitting there and she's got this song in her head. She can't get rid of. And all she knows is it starts off as everybody's talking. And you realise, oh, okay, that's the Harry Nilsson song. Everybody's talking about me. I can't hear a word they're saying. They're just echoes in my mind or something along those. And you suddenly think that song actually pertains to the whole of this book,
yes,
in terms of the mind transference.
Yeah.
And you think, did she do this deliberately? Look, if she didn't do it deliberately, it's fantastic. If she did do it deliberately, it's even more fantastic. So basically, I think she's handled this really, really well. This is a good debut novel. I'm really looking forward to her other works. I gather she's now working on a thriller. I'll be out there buying that one straight away. I think she's somebody to look forward to look at, to really enjoy. I gave this one 4.3 out of 5, David.
Very good.
Thought it was excellent.
All right. Well, I'm going to go back in my reading list a while. I must confess I haven't reread this recently, but it still sticks in my head from when I read it a couple of years ago. So this is a novel called 1Q84 by Haruki Murakami, translated by Jay Rubin and Philip Gabriel. It's a very long book. It was originally published in three volumes in Japanese. It was instantly popular in Japan. The first two volumes, which came out in 2009, sold over 1 million copies in Japan. And then a third volume, which hadn't been expected by the readers, came out in 2010. But it's not a trilogy. It's just this one very long book. In English translation, it runs to over 1,000 pages. In fact, you can buy a paperback of the whole thing for a 1,000-page long paperback. No, thank you.
It's a doorstop.
Yeah, absolutely. But when you read it, it's not at all tedious. Now, I didn't read it as a doorstop paperback. I read it in ebook format, and maybe that made it easier. You didn't feel the weight of a book this long. But as I say, it just flows as you read it. It just keeps going and wanting to find out what happens next. So it interleaves the stories of two young people, Ayamame and Tengo. And my apologies, of course, to our Japanese listeners that I'm probably not pronouncing either these names or the name of the author correctly, but never mind. Anyway, and these two people's stories are told in these alternating chapters. So we start with Ayamame, and she's a personal trainer in her late 20s, I guess. And at the start of the book, in the year 1984, she gets into a taxi and she's on her way to an urgent appointment. She tells the taxi driver, you know, she really has to get to where she's going. But they don't go very far before the taxi gets stuck in a traffic jam on the freeway. And it's just inching along. And the taxi driver says, look, there's no way you're gonna get there. And so she's really getting very frustrated. So the driver eventually tells her that there's a service access point up ahead, which has a staircase down to the ground below. So she gets out of the taxi and manages with considerable difficulty to make her way down to the ground, and is then able to catch the subway train. But something odd's happened during this process, and she finds this world is subtly different from what she remembers. The first thing she notices is that the uniforms of the traffic police are different from what she remembered. You know, when did this new uniform come in for these policemen? But then more and more, as you go on, things get more and more different from what she remembers. So eventually she starts thinking of it not as 1984, but as 1Q84, an alternate reality. But then you say, well, what was this urgent appointment? Well, so we follow her to this urgent appointment. Where was she going and why? And we discover that, in fact, although she works as a personal trainer, she has this side job, if you like. She's actually an assassin. And she's employed by a rich woman who runs an organization to look after the female victims of violence, domestic violence, and abuse by men. And so Ayamame is sent out by this organization to rid the world of the worst of these male perpetrators. And that's what, you know, in the early chapters of the book, we see her actually dispose of one of these particular guys. And eventually, she's tasked to investigate a religious cult, which seems to involve the sexual abuse of young girls. But it turns out to be considerably stranger than that. So that's Ayamame. And now we have Tengo, who's a mathematics tutor and an aspiring writer. He's just turning 30. And he's persuaded by an editor he knows to work on a manuscript which has been submitted to a national competition for new writers. And it's been submitted by this 17-year-old girl. So the manuscript has this intriguing story and shows a lot of promise, but it's basically very badly written. So the editor wants Tengo to rewrite the books entirely, but they're going to submit it to the competition under the girl's name. So it's essentially a fraud, an attempt to win the prize fraudulently. So Tengo eventually agrees and meets with this girl who's called Fuka Iri, who is very odd. And she insists that the story in her book, which is a fantastic story, is completely factual, but it involves her being involved with these little people and their weaving of something she calls an air chrysalis. She sees them weave this thing out of the air. The girl insists this is absolutely solid fact. It's true. And Tengo, of course, doesn't believe this at first. Then he slowly starts to be convinced that she's telling the truth. And indeed, she is. So there's a deep connection between these two people, Ayamami and Tengo. And it's slowly revealed in the first part of the book. They met long ago as children and haven't seen each other since. But they've been unable to get each other out of their heads. But I don't think they actually meet again, certainly not until late in the second book, might even not be until the third book. I can't remember now, it's a little while since I've read the book. But in the meantime, their interlinked stories sort of weave over this very interesting, strange territory. And so this world is, 1Q84 is odd in several ways. I think at one point they discover that there are two moons rather than one. And it's bound up with this girl, Fuka Iri, and her story of the little people and this air chrysalis. It's a very strange book, but it's not quite gripping, but it certainly sucks you in and makes you really want to keep on reading it. Is it science fiction? Yeah, sort of parallel timelines? Yeah. Is it fantasy? Yeah, these little people and this air chrysalis they weave. But maybe it's not. It's a very strange book, but it does seem to fit in this category of crossing the genres and not being easily to identify under one particular genre. I really liked it, and it's the first novel I've read by Murakami, but it probably won't be the last. I've got a couple of others of his novels on my list of to be read, but haven't managed to get all of them yet.
That massive pile of books piled up that you need to get to at some point, and the more and more our discussions go on, the more and more books that we find that we have to add to it.
That's very true.
Murakami's had a big, massive reputation, always up there in the discussions regarding the Nobel Prize for Literature. Should think that he will get it at some point or other. Probably the biggest name in Japanese literature at the moment, I would think.
Could well be, yeah.
Yeah, so look, yeah, he's certainly one that I've had an eye on, but where can I fit him in, David?
A 1,000-page paperback is a bit of a struggle.
Well, it is, and the three books that I'm looking at today were all probably around that 260, 280 mark, so if you take that as being 300, so that's, let's say, close on 1,000 pages, and that's a fortnight's reading, and, you know, that's like one episode of the podcast.
And yeah, that's right.
What about all the others? And anyway, moving on to another Australian book by another Australian female writer, Laura Jean McKay. The book is called The Animals in That Country. Now, this is a book that's taken its title from a poem called The Animals in That Country by Margaret Atwood. And the line that she quotes in the beginning of the book is, "In this country, the animals have the faces of animals." Okay. What the hell does that mean? I've got no idea. Anyway, so I'll just read that go. Yeah, okay, well, it's got to mean something or other, I guess. Don't know. Anyway, so the book starts off, we're set somewhere in the Northern Territory in a game park where our protagonist of the novel, Jean, is a grandmother, hard-drinking, foul-mouthed, drug-taking, who acts as a tourist guide, basically tries to keep herself sober enough to do the job, but only just about makes it. She lives on the property, lives on the park in a sort of a series of huts that the workers all stay there and all the tourists come to the park and then go away again, but the workers actually stay on the property itself. She lives there, as does her granddaughter, Kimberly, and the mother of her granddaughter, Angela. Angela's a ranger on the park. Now, if you're a ranger, you're allowed to interact directly with the animals. If you're a guide, you're not supposed to. Jean, of course, wants to become a ranger because she thinks she's pretty good with animals. And she's basically out one day guiding a tour with a whole bunch of tourists. When she comes across one of the exhibits, a dingo named Sue, who's been caught in a fence and has a piece of wire wrapped around its paw. So she gets down out of the little bus that she's in, jumps over the fence, goes out, tries to extricate Sue from the fence and gets badly bitten on the hand as a result. And Sue just runs off. Well, you don't think much of this and think, oh, well, she's going to get that fixed up. But she decides not to, because if she does, then somebody say, well, where'd you get this from? This is a bite. You've been dealing with the animals you're not supposed to. You're out. So she decides she's not going to do anything about this. Now, soon after this incident happens, there becomes news starts to spread of a new virus. Oh, here we go. Now, don't forget, this is written last year, prior to this pandemic. So published this year. So it's just happenstance, coincidence. This new virus, which is affecting the people of Australia, but starting in the southern states and sort of working its way up. The park is not affected by this particular virus in the first instance, until Jean's son, Lee, who's the father of Kimberly, turns up after they've completely closed off the park to not let any tourists in because they're worried about the virus coming in and everybody being infected. He gets in and breaks in just because he wants to see his daughter and infects everybody. Now, the thing about this particular virus, it's called the zoo flu, because it's described as a H7N7 subtype of influenza A virus. So it's an influenza virus, which impacts the cognitive areas of the human brain and starts allowing humans to understand and communicate with animals. And it starts off that once Lee gets into the park, everybody gets infected, and everybody then, you're only sick for about half a day, and then the side effect of it is that you start hearing animals talk to you. This isn't terribly good for a lot of people because it sort of sends them a little bit crazy. And a lot of people down south aren't doing terribly well because they've treated animals really badly, and the animals start telling them how badly they've been treated. And people don't really like this very much, so they try to clear out and get away from them. This starts sending a few people mad, as I said, and Lee is one of those who basically doesn't take it very well. So he takes Jean's car, takes Kimberly, and shoots off south after having told everybody that really what he wants to do is commune with the whales. So he heads off, and a day or two later, Jean decides that she'd better go off and get Lee and get Kimberly back because she's worried about where Lee's going. He's been a flaky kid all of his life. So she heads off and takes Sue, the dingo, with her because the two of them are sort of bonded by this stage, and Sue's basically talking to her and telling her a whole lot of things about what's going on and actually is able to lead Jean along the path to which Lee and Kimberly have taken. The book ends up starting to become a road journey. The two of them learning to communicate with each other as they go further and further down the road. And as they go down the road towards what I guess is the southeastern coast of New South Wales, the society around them is coming apart. They're having trouble finding food. They're having trouble finding water and petrol for the vehicle. And they keep on going. But as they gradually go further down the road, as they get closer and closer to the end, Jean realises that she's hearing more and more voices. She's starting to hear birds, and then she's starting to hear reptiles. And then when she actually gets down the coast, she actually starts to hear insects. And this is why a lot of people get really mad, because they get a whole cloud of mosquitoes coming at them, and all the mosquitoes are saying is, what blood, what blood, what blood? Oh, meat sack, what blood? And they're just flocking onto particular people and just driving them crazy. So I was a bit worried about this book at the start when this thing, when it started off and they were talking, when Jean was talking to the animals, to the dingo and so on. Because, look, animals are not that intelligent, and they're not going to have a long, detailed conversation. So everything's told in short, sharp phrases, and it's all in a sort of code that you have to try and translate. It takes a while to get into this particular book, and it's a really tough getting through it in the first part of it. But as it gets further and further along, you realise that Sue and Jean are having, they start off having sort of fairly inane conversations to get a little bit more detailed, and then become a bit threatening, because Jean starts realising that she's now in a pack with Sue, and Sue's trying to become more dominant, while Jean is feeling pretty bad from the bite on her hand, is getting lower and lower in terms of her energy levels. And so the power balance goes up and down with this. They end up finding Lee and Kimberly down on the coast, and there's a bit of a harrowing scene down at the end, which I won't describe because it'll give everything away. It comes together, the novel. I didn't think that the author would be able to do it, because I thought that, we're going to slip into something like The Road by Cormac McCarthy here. It's just going to get like a really rough, dystopian, terrible novel. But she doesn't quite allow it to go that far, which is good. But I think that the ending's a little bit rushed. It just seems like, oh, everything's fixed up and everything's fine and everything goes through. No, it doesn't really quite work that well for me. There's a lot of really good things about this particular book. The idea of the pandemic, or the epidemic. It's not a pandemic because it's basically only confined to Australia. But the epidemic within Australia, the conversations with the animals, there's a lot of interest. The style is difficult at first to handle, but you get into it and it works quite well. Look, I would recommend that people have a look at it and read it. I gave it 4.0 out of 5, which is pretty good. Not as good as Superior Spectre, but certainly one that people should have a bit of a look at.
Mm.
I believe it's been nominated for the Reading Award for Best New Australian Writing for this year. So certainly one of those that is getting a bit of attention.
Mm. Your description of it reminds me a bit of another work of, I guess, science fiction by an Australian female author, which came out a couple of years ago, called The Second Cure. I don't know whether you've seen that, by Margaret Morgan.
No.
That's very good. I can recommend it. And again, there's a virus happening, which is affecting people's mental state. And in this case, a couple of things it does. It creates synesthesia. It makes people have this condition of synesthesia where their senses get mixed up. But the other thing it does is it means that people lose their belief in religion. It changes their mental state, so they're no longer able to enter into a state of faith or belief in anything other than logic. It's a very good book. I can recommend it. But what you've been saying reminds me a lot of that one. So that's interesting. Yeah. All right, well, none of my authors this time are going to be Australian, unfortunately. But there are certainly Australian authors coming up who I'd like to talk about. In fact, I've just read a book, which I won't talk about today, by someone my daughter went to school with in primary school.
Okay.
Her name is Kate Mildenhall, and it's a book called The Mother Fault. And again, it's like a slightly dystopian Australia, where people have got chips in them to track them and stuff like that. So anyway, but I won't talk about it now. So my second book that I'm going to talk about at length is a book by Kate Atkinson. Now, I've talked on the podcast before about my love of her work, and she's a British author. In fact, she's almost my exact contemporary in age, and she's a Yorkshire woman. I'm a Yorkshire man. I was born in Yorkshire. So we have a lot in common, I think, Kate Atkinson and I, except that she is a fantastically best-selling author and I'm not. But never mind, apart from that minor difference.
Just a minor one.
Just a minor one. Yes, I really like her books. So when I talked on the podcast before about her books, I was mostly concentrating on her Jackson Brodie series of almost but not quite mystery novels. And this almost but not quite sort of description kind of tells you that a lot of her books cross over these genre boundaries. And her novels have rarely been promoted either as crime or as anything, you know, in fantasy or whatever. Today I want to talk about her second novel, which was published in 1997, called Human Croquet, which I've just reread with great enjoyment. It's a book which is, like all these genre adjacent things, that it's very hard to categorize or even describe, but I'll do my best. So Human Croquet starts with the first-person narrative by Isabel Fairfax, who is a 16-year-old girl living in the north of England in the 1950s and 1960s in a town called Glebelands. And she starts off by telling us the history of the world, or at least a brief summary of it, focusing on the coming of the trees and the forests. Now, the area where she lives used to be the Forest of Lythe, a very densely wooded area. Indeed, this theme of the forest and trees goes all the way through this book, and it's an ongoing theme through the book. Now, of course, this much of the dense forest that was there has been chopped down over the years, starting in the time of Henry VIII's shipbuilding, when they chopped down a lot of trees to make ships and masts and things on trees. And then, of course, accelerated by the Industrial Revolution. And now there's only a small portion of the forest, really just a few woods. But there's one centuries-old great oak called the Lady Oak, which remains within sight of Isabel's house. Now, Isabel's house is named Arden. Now, if you remember your Shakespeare periods, I'm sure you do, that will immediately remind you of the line out of Shakespeare's As You Like It, where they come into a particular area and she says, "Well, this is the Forest of Arden." And so that's what that reminds me of. And that's another theme that goes through the book, which is that Isabel has a pretty unhappy life. As part of that, she's become a keen reader. So she loves English literature. She loves Shakespeare, John Donne, Thomas Wyatt, a lot of other English literature. And so as you read the book, a lot of her narrative is sprinkled with these casual little bits. And you think, that's a familiar phrase. And it fits perfectly with what she's talking about. But you find out that, of course, it's actually a quote from somewhere, a quote out of Shakespeare or someone else. Now, she does have a somewhat unhappy life. She's you know, sort of an ordinary sort of schoolgirl, but her family situation is very odd. So we'll talk about that in a bit. So she's not doing all that well at school other than in subjects like literature. And she's sort of growing tall and awkward and isn't particularly pretty. And she seems to have no prospect at all of getting close to the boy that she has her eye on. And so, but she comments on her life and on her family and on her friends and on her neighborhoods in this really delightfully ironic, very often amusing manner. And we really quickly sort of become enamored of her character. But then she starts experiencing these strange episodes in which she seems to suddenly slip from her present day into the past. She might find herself suddenly in the local town as it was in Elizabethan times. Or she might be walking along the street and suddenly she's in Edwardian times when the forest was a bit more extensive than it is now. And once she finds herself in her grandmother's house when her aunt was a young woman. And so Isabel, like Billy Pilgrim, has come unstuck in time. Part of all this is that she's got this strange family situation. And we find out slowly, but we find out as we go along that Isabel's mother disappeared when Isabel was 5 or 6 years old. "Run off with a fancy man," is what her Aunt Vinnie tells her. But then only a day or so after her mother vanishes, their father also leaves. Supposedly he's going on a business trip. And he leaves Isabel and Charles with Charles is her brother. So it leaves Isabel and Charles with their grandmother and their very sour Aunt Vinnie. And he doesn't come back from this trip. And after some weeks, the children are eventually told that their father has died of an asthma attack in a London fog. So they sort of accept that. But then 7 years later, after all this, after their grandmother's died, their father returns out of the blue, very much alive. claiming he's been suffering amnesia all this time and has been living in New Zealand, where he's acquired a second wife. The children sort of take all this at face value, but we're immediately suspicious that something's been going on, and with good reason. So the book's broken into sections labelled the present, which is Isabel's narrative, and the past. And in the past, which is generally, you know, sort of third-person omniscient narrative, we slowly start to uncover what's really occurred with her parents, which is much, much darker than Isabel's been led to believe. And I've talked about how trees and forests are this theme through the book. And it's, well, this narrative is almost like a tree itself. It sort of sends down roots into the past to tap into what's been going on, and then branches out above into the light. And branching is a pretty good word, actually, because as we get towards the end of the novel, she's been experiencing these strange slips in time. But as we get closer to the end of the novel, Isabel finds herself living through four very different Christmases, Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, one immediately after the other, none of which turn out to be the reality, much to her relief. In one of these branches of time, or whatever you like to call it, Isabel is running away from a bunch of boys who are chasing her with lecherous intent, and she finds herself turned into a tree. "Call me Daphne," she says sadly, which again is a reference. So there's this strange fantasy or science fiction element, the time traveling, parallel timelines, what if you want, or the fluidity of reality, whatever you might like to call it. And we might accept the one explanation that's given at the end of the book, which is that Isabel has been fantasizing all of this while she's been in a coma. A tree fell on her. But by the end of the book, you're really not certain that that's really the true story. But it's a delightful book. I mean, it has some very dark elements to it, but it's a delightful and very rewarding book. And it's certainly more of a literary sort of work than a science fiction or a fantasy book. But so for me, it fits into this category of genre adjacent works. Now, Perry, you're going to ask me, why the title Human Croquet?
Yes, David, why the title?
Well, it turns out this is a real party game, which uses, instead of using metal hoops and wooden mallets and so on, it uses people instead of balls and hoops. There's even a set of instructions at the back of the book on how to play this game.
But not flamingos.
But no flamingos, no. So as the title of the book, I guess that the author means for it to represent this kind of slippage in time and the weird ins and outs of her family situation. But it's nice anyway. Yeah, it's thoroughly recommended. All of her books, I would say, are recommended, but this one was fun and certainly fits into this genre-adjacent sort of category, I would have thought.
I think it's interesting when you have authors who put in little snippets here and there, little nuggets of joy that you as a reader can pick up if you happen to get the connection. A bit like Superior Spectre with the John Voight film Midnight Cowboy. That if you don't know the song that is not laid out for you, only the first couple of the words of it, if you don't know it, you're not missing anything. But if you do know it, you get this extra bit of, oh, that's a little bit of a surprise. And it's good that some of these authors actually sort of bring this thing in. And I must admit, I do miss a lot of them. I feel really quite happy when I actually find something.
Yeah, it's delightful when you pick something out and you get it. But if it's well written, then it doesn't matter if you miss
it. No,
no, it's fine.
You can slide straight over the top of it and you're not actually missing anything. You can get a little bit extra from the book if you happen to pick these things up. And I think it shows a lot of talent to be able to put them in such a way that it can do that without the author without the reader feeling as if just completely lost.
Yeah, indeed.
Right, well, moving on to my third book, I have the second novel written by Robbie Arnott called The Rain Heron. Now, long-term listeners of this podcast will remember that Chong mentioned this in his roundup of best books of last year. I believe that he said that he read it in manuscript because he actually did the cover. And the cover is excellent. I can really tell you the cover is really nice indeed. This is a really wondrous book, I think. This is Robbie Arnott's first novel, which just completely passed me by. I didn't even know it was there. It was called Flames and attracted a lot of attention, which I missed. I mean, it was long listed for the 2019 Australian Literary Society Gold Medal, which is pretty high up. Also for the Miles Franklin Award, so that was pretty good. And it was shortlisted for the Victorian Premier's Literary Award for Fiction and also the Guardian's Not the Booker Prize. As you know, the Guardian newspaper does a Not the Booker Prize each year to pick up half a dozen books that they think have been neglected by the Booker Prize committees. And he made the shortlist for that.
Yeah, very good.
So he's got some talent. And Chong basically told me that this was pretty good, so I picked it up. And I was captivated right from the very beginning. Now, at the heart of this novel is the Rain Heron of the title. This is a mystical, mythical bird that drives the love, hatred, or acquisitiveness and death in this particular novel. It all revolves around this particular bird. Now, it's described variously throughout the book as being a ghost or a mirage. It's translucent, but it's got blue-grey feathers, which, when it flies, sheds water everywhere. And so it actually can bring rain to a particular local area, and it can actually turn everything really cold so it snows. So it can actually change the local weather very rapidly from hot and humid to cold and snowy when it needs to. But it's also got the predilection for pecking the eyes out of people who menace it and get too close. So while it's mystical, it is actually solid, and solid enough to cause some really bad physical damage. Okay, so the book's set in an unnamed country in an undocumented age. It reads like it's somewhere in the near future in a reasonably modern Western country, but it's never named, so you don't really know. You could say it's Australia and you'd be quite happy. It would quite fit to be able to do so. Now, a violent coup has overthrown the government and thrown the country under an authoritarian military rule. A middle-aged woman named Wren has retreated to live a feral existence on a mountainside, wanting to remove herself from human contact. Wants to remove herself completely from human contact. Can't, of course, quite do that because she's still got to trade whatever she makes or produces with some people, with things that she needs from a couple of people in a nearby village. She learns of the existence of this particular heron and sees what it is, doesn't really approach it, understands what it is and understands why it's there, and just leaves it alone and tries to guard its existence as best she can. Unfortunately, the myth of the rain heron has spread far and wide throughout this particular country, and the generals, when the generals talk, as Midnight Oil said, everybody listens. And when the generals want something, they want it. And they decide that being acquisitive, they just want this particular bird for no other reason than they want it. So they send a company or a squadron, whatever the size of the thing is, about 10 or so people, out to capture this particular bird. The troops are led by a young woman by the name of Harka, who in her own way is as physically, mentally and emotionally scarred as is Wren. But she's very, very good at her job and is able to basically destroy Wren's life to the extent that she's able to torture Wren enough so that Wren will reveal the existence of where the heron is. And so the heron is captured. But Harka does lose an eye in the process because she got too close and was too slow. And then the rest of the book, which I don't really want to talk over much about in terms of the plot, because I think that will give away too much of the interesting little things that go on here. That's sort of the first section of the book. The second section of the book, you start to read and go, oh, this is probably just a set of interrelated novellas that are going to come together somewhere down the track. And they sort of are, but the second section does hark back both to the first section and on into the future and gives you information. This second part of the book is set at the seaside where a particular village has found that a certain squid's ink has sort of semi-mystical powers. It will make certain culinary dishes taste spectacular. It will change paint so that a painting seems to just glow. And it's in very rare quantities, and it's very hard to get. And only this particular village knows how to harvest the particular ink and to ensure that the squids who produce the ink come back to be able to be harvested yet again. And it doesn't seem that this particular section is going to relate to the first, but it ends up doing so. And its ability to be able to talk about the environment that Wren lives in and the way that the heron relates to that, and how the second section of the ocean, how the villagers and the squid, how the squids all come together, how he deals with that is really quite excellent. He's certainly a writer to watch. There's a real mystical quality about this. It's got a, you know how you get those books where you read them and you think, this is beautiful writing, but I don't know how he's doing it.
Oh, absolutely.
I just don't know. It just flows beautifully. And it's almost like he's written it almost as poetry, that he's basically got it out, and it just flows fantastically. And you end up with a fable or a story which comes together, is a full whole, comes together at the end. There's a big piece of redemption and a return to a level of humanity by a couple of the people in this particular book. The Rain Heron, it's sort of a metaphor for lost humanity and regaining of that, that once you get close to it, all that greed and corruption sort of slowly fades away. And the longer you spend in its presence, the less of that you have, and the more that you come back to your core, basic, humane humanity rather than greed and avarice. He's a good writer, this bloke. Really good. I think he's one to watch. I'll certainly be going back and tracking down his first book and finding that. And I would really recommend this one. I don't know whether it's going to end up picking up any major awards, because, look, it doesn't mention Australia at all, so it can't pick up anything. It doesn't depict Australians and Australian way of life, so that it can't appear on the Miles Franklin Award list because of that. But I gave it 4.6 out of 5, so that would round it up to 5 on Goodreads. Look, it's right up there with my best of the year already. So
sounds good.
Yep, enjoyed it a lot.
Oh, that sounds good. I must check that out.
You can borrow it from me later, David.
Oh, thank you, Pete. When are these days when we can see each other again? Yeah?
5 years' time when you've got enough stacked up to be able to read it.
All right, well, I'm going to talk about my last book, which is called What the Wind Brings by Matthew Hughes. Now, as it happens, I had the opportunity to talk to Matthew Hughes, and this review will be followed by a short interview with him in which he talks about this book of his. And also, interestingly enough, Matthew Hughes has written quite a lot of science fiction and fantasy over the years, and has written quite a few stories in the Jack Vance Dying Earth sort of environment from the books of Jack Vance, a very far future scenario where magic has kind of become science, or science has become magic, whatever you'd like to call it. So he's written a lot in that series, and he's been given the authority to write a book in the Jack Vance space series in the same sort of environment as Vance's Demon Princes. So that's, you'll get all that in the interview anyway. But this is quite a different book. So he's a Canadian author who was born in England in 1949. He's, written a lot of science fiction and fantasy, although he started out writing, as you'll find from the interview, that he started out trying to write crime. He's even written a story about Wolverine in the Marvel Universe, Perry. So there you go. Interesting. That makes this particular book, What the Wind Brings, which was published last year in 2019, very interesting, because it's a well-researched piece of historical fiction. And it's just this slight element of fantasy element, which I'll mention. So it's what we might call genre adjacent in that respect, but it's certainly not a book you would nominate as being a work of fantasy. It would never be marketed as a work of fantasy. No, it's really a piece of, I think, very well written and well researched historical fiction. And it's, when you think about it, it's not that unusual for works of historical fiction to have a slight magical, fantasy, mystical element to them. Some of Dorothy Dunnett's Lyman saga has got that sort of slight fantasy element with the character called the Dame de Doutance. And even Neal Stephenson's Baroque trilogy, which is this massive trilogy of written in the sort of the era of same sort of time as the plague in London and Pepys' Diary and the fire of London, that sort of thing. So the late 1600s. And that has an element of fantasy right at the very end of that too. It's a very, you're looking very sceptical, Perry, about the Baroque trilogy, but it's well worth reading, let me tell you. I'm not sure I'll ever read it again, but it's a huge slab.
I know it's out there, haven't read it, but because it's a huge slab, I don't know whether I'll get time to. But it also, some of these also remind me of Guy Gavriel Kaye's work. If you haven't read anything by him, well, I think you should. There's another one that we probably need to get to talk to at some point down the track. But carry on.
Well, indeed. Okay, so let's go back to this particular book, which is What the Wind Brings. It's set in what is now the country of Ecuador, which is on the western coast of South America, if you don't know your geography. And it's set in the latter part of the 16th century, after the Spaniards have been in the region for some years. But nothing in the body of the novel actually tells you that directly. You only kind of intuit that as you're reading. And then you get to Matthew Hughes's fascinating afterword to the book, which is I'll talk about too when we get to it. And I'm not being critical of the story by saying that it doesn't tell you these things. It's just it's so well written that it just sucks you into the time and place, and because of the interest of the characters and the setting. So the novel concentrates on three very different characters, main character, point of view characters. In the very first chapter, we're introduced to one of the the character who I think is perhaps the most interesting of all of these, and her story is told in the first person. And this is a person whose name in English would translate as expectation. Expectation is a member of the Nigua people who are native to this region of South America. And expectation tells us that she has what she calls a discrepancy. And I'll use the pronouns she and her to refer to expectation. But in fact, it's clear that physically she is neither male nor female, but a true hermaphrodite. And also possibly somewhat dwarfish in stature. Now, she hasn't been killed at birth, which is what would happen to a lot of babies with strange abnormalities, but she's been kept on. Now, the Nigua people live a tribal sort of life in the jungles of the region, and their society dictates the separation of unmarried people. So if you're not married, you either live in the men's house or you live in the women's house. But expectation, of course, is denied access to either of those. And so she has to live by herself, and she's become the tribe's shaman or spiritual guide, whatever you like to call, and healer. She heals people. And because of this gender ambiguity of her, the tribe's leaders tend to look at her with a fair bit of suspicion and a bit of disgust. But she's proved this, that she's very useful to them because they say she's become a healer. Anyways, the book opens. Expectation goes on what she calls a spirit journey, and she sees a sailing ship heading towards the nearby coast, and her spirit guide tells her that someone on the ship is going to be very important to the Nigua people. And so here's this fantasy element which runs through the book. And in fact, Expectation, really, with this first person character, in many ways is a mover and shaker. She directs a lot of what goes on. As, again, you'll pick up some of this from the interview with Matthew. So on board this ship that's coming in is the second main character, who's a Negro servant of a Spanish family. He's a servant, I think, not a slave, and he's been given quite a bit of responsibility. He's a young man called Alonso de Lescas, I'm probably not pronouncing that right, which is the name of the family that he serves. Alonso has been named for the head of the family, Don Alonso, back in Seville. And his responsibility on board the ship is to look after his patron's goods. They're on a ship which is supposedly on its way from Nicaragua to Lima, which is further south. And he's there to look after the goods of his patron, which include a small herd of pigs on board the ship and a valuable shipment of African slaves, some of whom have tried to rebel on the island of Hispaniola, which is in the Caribbean. Now, the leader of that group is a powerful man called Anton. Anyway, the ship has bad luck with the winds and doesn't make any progress in getting south to Lima, and they start running out of water and food. And so the captain makes a decision to make landfall to replenish their supplies. Anyway, they make landfall in the region which is occupied by the Nigua people. And they land near a creek and start to investigate the area, and they find an old village which has been abandoned, apparently fairly recently. And they were able to take some crops and some fruit from there. But before they can put to sea again, there's a violent storm comes up and it smashes the ship into the reef and wrecks it. And while this is all going on, Anton, the leader of the group of slaves, takes this opportunity to escape his bonds, and he frees the other slaves, and they quickly overpower the sailors. And the life of Alonso hangs in the balance because, he's the one who's kind of seen as the one who's been on the side of their masters or their owners, these slaves. But Anton's wife urges Anton not to kill Alonso because she thinks that Alonso knows how the Spaniards think and he speaks their language fluently and he knows their ways. They're certain that the Spaniards will try to recapture the slaves, so this may be useful information. Anyway, the slaves and Alonso eventually come into contact with the Nigua, and they come across a village and they get involved. They eventually get deeply involved with this tribe and kind of settle down. They kill off some of the men and settle down with native wives. But the main interest is with this character Alonso, who lives this very precarious existence. His life is all in the balance for a long time, and he's eventually taken in by Expectation, who now knows that he's the person that the spirit guide was telling her was the important one. And he's a sort of diffident sort of young bloke, and he doesn't have much self-confidence. And so his life is very precarious because Anton could have him killed at any moment. But Anton keeps tolerating him. Then as time goes by, Alonso starts to develop himself, and this is a lot of this is driven by Expectation. She sort of helps him. There's actually a passage where she finds what she says is his lost spirit, lost animal spirit, and she goes into the spirit world to recover this spirit for him. And in fact, from that point onwards, he becomes much more self-confident after she's told him this. Eventually, Alonso becomes a threat to Anton, and of course, that's a worry. And then we have a third character who's a Trinitarian monk called, I'll try to pronounce this properly, my Spanish is not good. Apologies to all our Spanish listeners as well. Alejandro de Espinosa. And he's fled Spain for the New World because he has a Jewish grandfather. And so he's suspected of being a converso, who is a Jew who is merely pretending to be a Christian to escape persecution. He becomes involved in a very ill-fated expedition into the interior of the jungle. And the Spaniards are attacked by another tribe called the Campaze, who are equipped with poison darts, and they know the jungle very well, and they basically massacre most of this expedition. And Alejandro and the remains of the expedition only sort of get back to the coast alive. Only a few of them get back. Anyway, eventually Alejandro is sent on another expedition, which is north, to try to make contact with where they know the slaves washed up and have been starting to trade, make a bit of a community there and build up a community and start to trade with people. And the Spaniards want to kind of make contact and get their help to build a port in the area. But the Spaniards mistakenly think that Alonso, not Anton, is the head of the group, and they offer to make Alonso the governor of the province if he'll assist in helping them set up this port. This, of course, doesn't improve relations with Anton, and eventually all this comes to a head, and there's a conflict between them, which I won't go into without spoiling things. But I really enjoyed this. It was a really engaging read, really interesting, beautifully written, very good characterization. You really get sucked in by these characters, so you really want to follow the story and find out where all these characters end up. And it seems to have been very well researched. But I actually got to the end of the book, and there's an afterword. And I was really startled on reading this, because until this point, I thought this was just a really clever bit of ingenious storytelling in a very interesting environment. But in fact, the afterword tells you that almost all of this is true. It's really based on an absolutely true story. All the main characters were real historical figures who were noted in history. And I think that's it actually takes a lot of talent to take an existing story like that with real people in it, where you don't know a lot about them, but you know that they're real historical figures, and turn it into a piece of good storytelling and make the characters come to life. So I enjoyed it a lot, and so I can recommend it. And as I say, in a little while, we'll move to an interview with Matthew Hughes, and where he talks about both this book and his forthcoming book in the Jack Vance space.
Sounds interesting. Sounds interesting.
Indeed, indeed. All right, well, we might go off to that interview now. I'm talking today with Matthew Hughes, the author of What the Wind Brings, about how he came to write this historical novel after a long career of writing mainly science fiction and fantasy novels. He's written an enormous number of novels and short stories over the years, mostly in the science fiction and fantasy genres. But he also written some crime fiction. He started out writing crime fiction. So, Matthew, how did you come to write this particular novel in the historical fiction genre?
Well, okay, there's a long story behind it. In about 1971, I saw a footnote in a university book I was reading about cultural clashes and cohesions. And it mentioned African slaves shipwrecked on the coast of Ecuador who survived and flourished and created an independent state. And I thought, well, that sounds like a good historical novel.
Sure.
And back in 1971, I was actually thinking I would be a historical novelist if I ever got, you know, the time and the leisure to write. So I filed it away in my head, and then I went on with a career as a professional writer. I became a journalist first, and then by a sheer fluke, I ended up in the office of a Canadian member of parliament, newly elected, who was seconded to give, or was tapped to second the speech from the throne, as we call it in Canada. I know in the UK, it's called the Queen's Speech. It's where the new government lays out its entire agenda.
Yeah.
I'd never written a speech before. This fellow had hired me really to write newspaper columns for his, you know, the writing press. I had been editing a paper in that writing when he got elected. But I went and got some examples from the speaker's office of how do you do speeches, and I wrote him a speech. And the next thing I knew, I was being offered jobs by cabinet ministers to come and be on the personal staff and write speeches. And that's what I did for 3 years more in Ottawa. And then I came back to BC, British Columbia, Vancouver, and I freelanced essentially for 30 years. All the time, I was thinking I'd rather be a novelist. I started out to be a crime novelist. That worked. I won an award from the Crime Writers of Canada, and I got a novel published by Doubleday, and I sold short stories to Alfred Hitchcock's magazine, and, you know, I was beginning to
doing
build
well.
A career.
Yeah, sure.
But an old fantasy novel that I'd written years before, I saw an opportunity to sell it to somebody, and I did, and they asked for a sequel, and that was Time Warner Books.
Mm-hmm.
And then an editor at Tor said, I'd like one of those, so why don't you write one for me? And I did. And then Nightshade Books, very reputable in those days, small press, said, well, we'd like some novels too, so here's some money and the contract. And next thing I knew, I was a science fiction and fantasy author.
All right. I see. That's interesting.
But all the time, in the back of my head, was this historical novel story. I tried over the years to research it, but it was difficult because all the scholarship, the events having taken place in Ecuador, all the scholarship was in Spanish language academic journals. And I'm capable of saying, you know, ¿dónde está la pluma de mi tía kind of thing, but I'm not very good at academic Spanish. It wasn't until well into this century that North American academics caught up with this thing and began to write about it. And then I could actually research it. So I went to the Canada Council for the arts and said, could I have some money? And they gave me $25,000. And then I dropped everything and sat down and wrote four drafts of this novel, which had been cooking in the back of my head for, by then, more than 40 years.
Yeah, wow.
It came out, I'm not a plotter and outliner. I start with characters and a situation, and then I see what happens with them. And I'm constantly asking my characters when we get to a deciding point, well, you know, what do you want now? What do you need? What happens next? And the guy in the back of my head tells me, and we go on and do it.
That must be a lot harder with a historical novel there, where you're constrained by the actual historical events and the actual characters.
Yes, it is certainly more constraining than, when I'm just making up stuff on my own for, a dying earth kind of fantasy novel. Yes, it is. But in this case, the characters that I knew had to be in there because they were actual real historical people, Alonzo Iescas, the educated slave who was in charge of the cargo of African slaves on the ship that got wrecked on the reef, he was real. And he started out as just the supercargo. And he was certainly not the leader of the group after they landed and began to establish themselves. That was another fellow known to exist called Anton, whom I saw as a pretty tough and rugged kind of fellow. So I had them already. And somehow, nobody knows how, because nobody was there writing it down, somehow Anton ceased to be the leader and Alonzo became the leader. And that was the crux of the story. I had a pair of character arcs I knew I could work with after I created the characters to fill them. And of course, finally, there was this hermaphroditic shaman who was entirely my own made-up person, who just popped into my head one day with her name. Her name was Expectation. I don't know why that was her name, but that was what she was called. And I could see her as the key person who was going to make everything work, but it was not going to be easy for her.
Well, she's certainly a fascinating character throughout the book.
I think of her as a mini Machiavelli. She's one of positions and moves everybody in order to get the result that is best for everybody, except for Anton.
Yeah, well, indeed. And it's interesting, I guess, that she's the only first person point of view character in the book, I think. So she is kind of driving things in that sense.
Yeah, because her perspective is really the perspective that counts in the whole story. And the moment I started writing her parts, it was in the first person. And that was just natural. That was how it was going to be.
Sure. Yeah, and certainly she drives the story very much. And I guess she's the one who brings in this very slight fantasy element to the book, which I think works very well. She communes with her spirit guides, and she's the one who sort of heals Alonso, recovers his spirit for him.
Yeah.
Now whether you take that as fact or fantasy, I don't think it matters. It kind of works very well, I think.
It doesn't, but I like it. I would ask the reader for that suspension of disbelief and say, yes, I believe this is actually happening, because it's magical realism more than fantasy, I think.
Yes.
And nothing more South American than magical realism.
Yes, and I think, as I said in my review, it's not that unusual for historical novels to actually have a slight element of fantasy. So you wouldn't see What the Wind Brings as a fantasy novel by any means, but it's definitely, I think, in the historical fiction category, but just has a slight element of fantasy to it, which I think is delightful, really. It works really well.
It is historical fiction with a tinge.
And the third major character, I guess, fourth, as well as Alonso and Anton and Expectation, there's this Trinitarian monk. What was your impulse to bring him into the book?
Well, he was a real person. He actually, his name was not Alejandro, it was Alonso. I changed his name because we already had two Alonzos. But he was a real person who came and joined the Zambo state, along with his Portuguese friend, who was a Portuguese mercenary, Avila. And they became useful to the people that they were. But when I brought him in, I wanted him to be in this whole political novel. And this is basically a political novel. Mm-hmm. I wanted him to be the one innocent, pure person who shines in the murk of the rest of them. So I figured, as a Trinitarian monk, and they were, again, I had to guess his background because nothing really was written down. Trinitarians were actually to be found on the pilgrim routes going to the Holy Land, where they helped pilgrims along the way. That was their raison d'etre as an order. But this fellow probably was, so I made him such in the book, he was a descendant of Jews who had been forcibly converted in the time of Ferdinand and Isabella, 1490s, after the conquest of Granada. And by the time this book takes place in the 1550s, 60s, people like that were being hunted by the Inquisition because they had position and money often, and the Inquisition got whatever you had if they came after you. Often people simply paid over their what they had as their fortunes, and the Inquisition would let them alone. Other people who could not pay were sometimes burned to death or flogged to death or whatever, awful things. At the time I'm writing about, the Inquisition was not yet extended to South America. So it was a logical place for a converso to flee and be safe, relatively safe. And that, to me, was the reason why a man who was devoted to helping pilgrims to the Holy Land would go thousands of miles in the opposite direction. And then I figured he must be a reasonably good person to be a monk of that kind to begin with. So I made him innocent, and I brought him out, and he's determined to do good. And he's quite, he has courage, and he is really determined. He's going to help people as best he can.
Hmm. As I said in my review, I really enjoyed the book, and I'll look forward to reading some more of your work. And along those lines, I believe that you're writing a book in the universe or the environment created by Jack Vance, who's another of my favorite authors in the science fiction world. So you're writing a novel in the same sort of setting, if we like, as the Demon Prince's novels that that Jack Vance wrote. Now, was that something you were commissioned to do, or?
Well, okay. Again, a backstory to it. I had been writing materials, fiction, both space opera and stories set in my extrapolation of his seminal Dying Earth milieu. I'd been writing that for some number of years, and people were calling me his heir apparent, or George R. R. Martin said I was the closest thing to Vance since Vance.
Mm. That's high praise.
I thought so, yes. What I did eventually, I thought, well, I'll get in touch. So I got in touch with John Vance, his son, down in Oakland, and I said, would your dad be agreeable to my writing a sequel to one of his works? I was thinking then of the Dragon Masters.
Mm, yes.
And he went to his dad, and because that was the first thing I read of Vance's way back in 1962 in Galaxy magazine, and it stuck with me forever, made me a Vance.
Me too, and those wonderful illustrations by Jack Gaughan.
Yes, wonderful stuff.
Yep.
Anyway, so he went to his dad, and his dad said, yeah, I'm amenable to that. And I started talking to Jack's agent. I did not have and still don't have an agent of my own. And we started putting together a deal where it would be a 50-50 split, and you know, I would have permission to work with his characters and settings. And we were in the middle of doing that when Jack died back in May of 2013. And John did not feel good about continuing with that. I mean, he was in grieving for his father, and I perfectly understood that. So we dropped it. When he set up Spatterlight Press, which publishes his father's works in the Vance Integral Edition texts, the, you know, the ones that were restored to the way Vance wanted them to be, I got involved with him, and I wrote some of the blurbs for YouTube and the back copy for the books, and even did an introduction to Inferio, which is one of my favorite Jack Vance works. So we kept in touch, and then last year sometime, he launched this new initiative called Vance Space, in which people can write stories set in Vance's environments. Mm. And when he gave someone a contract to write a sequel to The Dragon Masters, that reminded him of what we'd talked about years before. So he got in touch and said, you know, do you still want to do a Vance story? And I said, yeah. And I'd thought about it since. And I said, what I'd really like to do is a sequel to The Demon Princes. Mm. Essentially, what happened to Gerson after his enemies deserted him? And we talked about it a bit. And the idea that he had for Vance Space was that it would not be Vance's characters, but just Vance's settings. You know, so somebody has done an Alastor cluster novel. And the Dragon Masters is in some way in process. So he said, and I agreed with it, the idea, if I could come up with the story set in the milieu of the Demon Princes without using Kurth Gerson, you know, rest in peace, Kurth, that'd be fine. Mm. So I sat down and I thought up an idea and started to work. And we have an agreement for it to be published by Spatterlite once we're both happy with the text. It's about a young woman. There weren't very many female protagonists in Vance stories, and that's why one reason I wanted to do something slightly different.
Sure.
She is the daughter of people who were kidnapped when the Demon Princes made the raid on Mount Pleasant and hauled off into captivity as slaves in the Beyond, where she was born. Her parents, you know, they were expecting her when they were taken by the slavers. And she has come back to the world Providence, where Mount Pleasant is, and the community of Mount Pleasant, which has been repopulated by some mild-mannered cultists who have built a philosophy around psychedelic drugs. Her parents hid something very valuable there. And she comes to get it because she can then take it to Interchange and buy them out of slavery. Hmm. And that's the basis for the story. And then things get complicated, and it doesn't quite work out that way. And other people come into it, and it's, again, character-driven fiction. But I think it's faithful to a Jack Vance kind of story. It's full of anti-heroes. Mm-hmm. There aren't any really pure good people. There are some really bad people, and then there are some people who'd like to be good and are trying to be, but it's, you know, it's a complicated world they're in. Hmm. I've now done a number of drafts. We're up to about a 61,500 word thing, which I think does the job. I'm waiting. I've sent it to John, and I'm waiting to hear his notes on it. It's in the mid-range between the shortest of the Demon Prince's books is 52,000 words. The longest is 72,000. So I'm right in the midpoint. Mm-hmm. And I'm very happy with it. I think it works. Mm. I'd like to see it. I really should have an agent for this kind of thing. I've been working without an agent for years now, selling mostly to small presses and to the magazines and anthologies. Spatterlite, John Vance's press, they do print-on-demand paperbacks and ebooks. Mm-hmm. They don't do audiobooks, and they don't do mass-market paperbacks. And I think this book has real potential as a mass-market paperback.
Yes.
But I would need two things. I would need John's agreement to, you know, have somebody go and see about selling that, and then I would need an agent who could to handle it. And while I'm making wishes, I think What the Wind Brings is a perfect property for streaming services and studios these days in Hollywood.
Yes, it would
because
be.
Because it's full of diversity, and it's got a happy ending.
Yes, yeah, yeah. It would actually make a great TV series on one of those streaming services. Yeah.
If I can find an agent who will do that, take that in, I think it's not a hard sell.
Sure. Oh, well, I wish you every luck with that. That sounds great. Yeah, look, I'm looking forward to...
Maybe somebody will listen to the podcast and say, hey, I could make 150.
Yeah, indeed. That sounds terrific. Well, let's hope they do. Yes. All right. Well, that's been great, Matthew. I've enjoyed that. I've certainly enjoyed reading your book. It's the first one of your books I've read, I confess.
Can I add one more thing?
Absolutely. Anything you like.
As I say, I have been writing within Vance universes, especially The Dying Earth. I've done a lot of that. Two collections of stories, all of which either ran in the magazine of fantasy and science fiction or the Garden of Dozois' anthologies.
Yep.
And then last year, July last year, I did the first novel set in The Dying Earth, and it's called A God in Chains. Came out from a Canadian small press, Edge Publishing. And if you like Vance, I think if you could get your hands on that one, you might find that to your taste.
Sure, that sounds great. I will certainly do that. Yeah, indeed. All right, well, thank you, Matthew. It's been very pleasant to talk to you and say I really enjoyed What the Wind Brings, and I look forward to reading more of your work.
And feel free to review the hell out of them.
Indeed. Okay, great. Terrific. Thank you, Matthew. Okay, great. Nice to see you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Matthew. That was very enjoyable.
I think we've had a pretty good run of books today. There's been some an interesting range of topics, but I think it just shows you that there are hidden gems out there. That even if you if you're a reader of literary fiction and you want to try a bit of speculative stuff, some of these books might be a good introduction for you. If you're a reader of genre fiction, you might find some interesting pieces here that you had not heard of or had just passed you by. Hopefully you'll find something good. Next week, David, we're back to the Hugo time machine.
Indeed.
With the Hugo Awards of 1964. Mm. We'll tell you the winner when we get there next week, but you can always look it up.
There's a very good website you can look it up on.
We will actually tell you about that website next time, one that I use quite a lot, and I find it very, very invaluable for the work that we do. But anyway, David, it's been another good episode, another long episode, but
yeah,
there we go.
But
it gives people something to have a bit of a think about in these troubled times.
Indeed.
Anyway, David, until next episode, I'll see you.
We'll see you then. Okay,
see you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.